Now, we're talking all about WannaCry, this ransomware attack that hit over the weekend. And we are joined tonight by Stephen Cobb. He's a senior security researcher at ESET. Stephen, it is great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Now, Stephen, we've all heard of ransomware. We've heard of things like, you know, it started with things like CryptoLocker, and it's evolved since then. But we're really hearing about WannaCry from all different news outlets all around the world. And, you know, the question comes out, you know, is this all hype? What is different about WannaCry? There have been ransomware attacks in the past. So what is, you know, your perspective on what WannaCry is and why it's so significantly different?
All right, so WannaCry, or which we detect as something that we called it WannaCryptor, and different companies have called it slightly different names, but this thing which started to hit on Friday really is a blend of a fairly standard ransomware that encrypts files and asks for money paid in Bitcoin to decrypt the files, but with a spreading technique which borrowed from an actual NSA tool or exploit that is very, very effective. So once this thing hits a network, it can spread very, very quickly within the network. And so this is not how typically a criminal would want to spread a piece of ransomware, because as you can see from the news coverage over the last 4 days, the person who released this, or persons who released this, instantly jumped to the top of the cyber most wanted list. So, and it's because of this infectious capability, which we would refer to as a worm capability. And it, and if, you know, if listeners are and viewers are in this space, worm is something which goes back to the very beginning of the internet,
right?
Where something called the Morris Internet Worm proved, kind of accidentally, that worm code, which is self-replicating code, can spread incredibly quickly, can block the whole internet. Back then it did. And there have been outbreaks since then, over time, where somebody's released something onto the internet, which has used that highly connected state of internet machines to spread very quickly, and then within companies, which many of which have huge networks of connected machines, spread very, very quickly within those networks. And that led to this rapid pace of distribution.
And we're looking at, you know, we hear about ransomware attacks where there are one or two companies that are infected and they lose their files, they're encrypted. And we hear that in the news. But this is, you know, what is the difference in scale here? What are we looking at?
So I haven't checked the latest figures, but it rapidly went to 100,000 and 200,000. Systems.
Company? I think it's. Is this companies? Individual companies?
Well, see, it that gets tricky to pass the statistics. I think we would say that's 200,000 systems. I mean, it's close to 300,000 now.
Wow.
And then we saw it spreading country to country. And obviously, the first big reports were those coming out of the National Health Service in the UK, where I think actually probably out of an abundance of caution, a lot of systems were shut down proactively, which was a smart thing to do. You know, back in 2000, when the I Love You worm broke out from the Philippines, it was the decision of a lot of companies and frankly, federal agencies and government agencies, just to pull the plug on the internet.
Sure, yeah. An example, I was speaking with somebody who runs the towers at all the airports in Canada, and they just literally ripped out the internet. They have no internet now.
Yeah, I mean, it was infectious in a way which really wasn't well controlled.
Sure.
And so, you know, you this leads us to kind of speculate about who did this. You know, was it somebody who realized what would happen? Because the use of ransomware by criminals is endemic, but it tends not to get reported. I mean, we hear of lots and lots of cases of companies and individuals, you know, getting their photographs encrypted and money asked. You know, there's a whole area of the internet where you can learn about what Bitcoin is to go and pay your ransomware, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of these ransomware programs have their own customer service to help people get the Bitcoin.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and think about it. You know, my wife showed me something last night, a Venn diagram of people using unpatched systems and people who know how to get Bitcoin. And they really don't overlap that much, right? I mean, for about a year now, I've been asking audiences when I speak, how many people know how to pay something with Bitcoin?
Right.
And very few people do. So yeah, a good piece of ransomware has instructions on how to make the payment. And they do provide customer service.
And I did notice that with WannaCryptor, that its interface has a button that says, how do I buy Bitcoin or something like that? Like it's
Because you have to explain it to people. And so you're looking at very profitable malware scheme here, but one which you would conduct in a fairly orderly manner, typically. And we've seen ransomware so far. Before WannaCry, we saw kind of two levels. Mm-hmm. One is the use of email to random people to infect them with infected email. The other is more targeted, where we have seen criminals go after an institution they know has valuable files.
Okay.
And the classic being a hospital.
Sure.
And then you can make, instead of ask for $300 in Bitcoin, you can ask for a lot more money. And we've seen plenty of cases of that against hospitals around the United States.
And we were speaking with Mark Skilton a little bit earlier, and one of the points that was made is that these are industries and these are networks that perhaps don't have the budget in order to upgrade, and that's the very reason that we have this exploit in existence. Now, I want to back up just a little bit, because here on the show, Stephen, we do try to avoid conspiracy theories when we can. And we hear about the NSA exploit that is involved in the capabilities of this ransomware to spread. Can you back that up for us with just a little bit of, you know, what this is not a ransomware that was created by the NSA. This is something that is exploiting a factor in Windows that was created by the NSA. Is that a correct way to look at it?
Yes. So in its role as a spy agency and a protector of American interests, the NSA, like agencies in other countries, like GCHQ in the UK, explores malicious code capabilities, or they probably wouldn't even call it malicious code, but penetration code or network monitoring code. And they found a hole in part of Windows called SMB. And they developed...
That's file sharing, just strict file sharing.
Yeah, and they found a way to exploit that. And they wrote the code for it. And there were actually two parts of the code. The part that gets a starring role in this is called Eternal Blue, you know, one of those computer-generated code names they use at the NSA.
Yeah.
So the NSA has been creating these codes, which exploits unpublished vulnerabilities, shall we call them, or sometimes they're called zero-day exploits. They've been doing this for some time, and they have a collection of this stuff, and it was compromised. So a group called Shadow Brokers has been making this secret NSA code available. And so the code that is Eternal Blue, which is the bit which is leveraged by WannaCry, is out there. I mean, you can literally go to GitHub and download it.
Oh, okay. So this is the code that the NSA developed? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've got the NSA developing secret code that exploits publicly unknown vulnerabilities that are unpatched in commercial products. It keeps those secret to use for its own purposes. But somebody stole them or leaked them. And so those have then been published. This group, the Shadow Brokers, they wanted money for it. They didn't get money for it. So they published some of this code.
Okay.
People then figured out how to, you know, put that into practice in the real world. And in fact, we saw this last month already being used in various ways out on the internet. And in fact, we were protecting in the ESET product against this vulnerability before WannaCry came on the scene.
It's an interesting fact, hey? Like, you've known about this and you've protected against it before it happened. So, you know, it's Windows XP that can't be updated. It's hacked versions of Windows 10 that that can't be updated that still have this exploit in existence.
So one of the things that happens with an outbreak of code like this is that you kind of find out the weak points in the global infrastructure, right? So as you correctly say, XP, which actually is supported by Microsoft. So to be clear, you know, Windows found out about this problem, this vulnerability in March and patched it. And they actually patched it for XP and some other unsupported systems if people were paying for support. So say you're a large manufacturing facility and you've got a lot of robots that run Windows XP, right? You may pay for Microsoft support. Microsoft will support you. But what the world discovered on Friday is there's a large number of people using bootleg XP, bootleg Windows 7, bootleg Windows 10. And particularly in developing countries, you know, where they either can't afford to get a licensed version of something, or they can't afford the support, or the, you know, they need something which runs on cheap hardware. So a lot of systems out there were not patched, and those were susceptible to this problem.
Can I ask, like, when you look at a heat map of the attack, Russia is red with this attack. Is it because of, like, is it an attack on Russia, or is it just that they are using a lot of vulnerable applications?
You really get into a lot of trouble drawing too many conclusions from a heat map, right?
Sure. This is what's deceiving about that heat map, because it really looks like that's the case, but is it just illegal copies of Windows?
But you don't know why those systems are infected, right? So you can say, oh, look, somebody targeted Russia because it's all infected. Or you might say, no, nobody in Russia had patched anything. Yeah. You know, so it's like, you don't know which of those it is.
Sure.
We had our own heat map, which was fairly useless because it was showing how many of our customers were infected, and very, very few were, if any, right?
Yeah.
So it depends. You know, there's a lot going on in something like that reporting, and just like, you know, the question of who created this is just very difficult to determine. Without a lot of information,
right,
and typically more than you can see in the code.
And do you suspect that this is a very successful hacker that is doing this to make a lot of money, or do we suspect that this is potentially cyber warfare that is trying to create a smokescreen for something else, as we were speaking about earlier in the show? What's the suspicion in on that front?
So I think at this point it is very difficult to distinguish, even probabilistically, between multiple different scenarios. One scenario is that somebody who didn't understand the implications of what they were doing thought this would be a cool thing to do, to add a worm capability to a piece of ransomware and push it out there. You know, and they'd make money quicker than anybody else. Mm-hmm. That hasn't worked, by the way, because there are other ransomware programs that have made a lot more money than this one. Mm-hmm. Another scenario, as you kind of hinted, might be a havoc factor. You know, let's kind of wreak havoc here.
Sure.
Because if you knew what the implication of the code was, you would know this thing would spread very, very quickly.
Right.
Or, you know, another scenario would be that somebody wanted to point out how insecure our internet infrastructure is around the world, and there's a precedent for that. You know, the very first macro virus that spread widely was a proof of concept. And so the motives of virus writers and people who release malicious code are very difficult to ascertain until you get to speak to them in person.
We're speaking with Stephen Cobb. He's a senior security researcher with ESET. Questions in the chat room at this point in the interview?
Yes, we do. We have a few wonderful questions here. I actually have two right now that have been really going around. Firstly, we just want to have confirmation of how exactly this stuff spreads, right? So, like, is it through emails? Is it through downloads? Things like that. And the second part of that question, are other systems also in danger, like Mac, other systems such as Linux, things like that, older versions maybe, but what about the new stuff? So that a lot of people are asking those questions as well.
So to take the second part of that first, this particular, you know, WannaCry, this particular thing which we dubbed WannaCryptor and broke out on Friday is a Windows threat. All right, so it's written to exploit Windows. Technically, though, it would be a mistake to say you couldn't have a similar outbreak on other operating systems. And we certainly have seen ransomware for all of the different from Linux, Mac operating system, Android, iOS. People are trying to exploit those vulnerabilities and weaknesses in those systems in order to extract ransom, even if it's as simple as locking up your phone until you pay to unlock it. In terms of exactly how this one spread, I think my understanding at this point, and we're still doing analysis on this, is that it was probably seeded through email attachments. And that's the classic where, you know, there is an attachment to email, which is very intriguing. You are tempted to click on it. That brings down the malware, the first part of the malware, onto your system. And then the malware calls back to the command and control center, the C2, and gets instructions. And then, in this case, sees if it can spread to other computers connected to your computer. And so that is where a lot of the speed and impact of the spread came from. And in fact, that was also the way that was implemented and ended up being a weakness in this particular version of the code, because that C2 connection was open to interference. And that's what happened when somebody, a gentleman from the UK, registered the domain that was being used for the command and control center, and that essentially sinkholed the thing and triggered a kill switch within the code. Those things, the kill switch and the C2, are standard parts of many different kinds of malware. But it was generally considered to be a mistake that you could actually just trigger a kill switch through the through registering that domain. So right. Again, that you know, and these are things we take as clues as to, you know, who was behind it. It was certainly somebody who made a mistake.
Wow.
Right. Now, Stephen, what can users do to protect themselves, like individually and also as businesses?
So I think the one word that, you know, if you had to boil it down to, would be patch, right? It would be make sure you are installing your operating system patches. I mean, a lot of systems now, Windows 10 is doing automatic patching for a lot of people. And so you want to make sure if you can, as an individual user or as a company, if it's feasible, do automatic patching. Do not delay if Microsoft comes out or Apple comes out with a critical update or an update that says fixes security vulnerabilities, you want to install that.
Right.
On the other hand, you have to note that it's not as easy as it sounds, and this is something which is being lost, I think, in some of the news reports, is if you install a big patch on a 200 unit network, a 200 seat network, and that crashes the network, right? You've got problems. Typically, what happens in a company situation is that the IT department receives the patches, tests them to make sure they don't break anything that you're using, and then rolls them out. And so that can delay things. There are some systems which it's infeasible to update. And an example would be embedded operating system, where the operating system is part of a set of code, and this happens in medical equipment, that's been certified at a certain set configuration. And so it's not necessarily possible to just immediately update that, right, and so on. The corollary to that is you should be reusing. So the second thing after patch is security software. You know, there's good security software out there. that was already looking for the exploit that was included in WannaCrypt. And a good security suite will protect against something like this, particularly if you've got cloud updating enabled. So, you know, for in our product, but other products as well, you have a cloud connection to your security software, so that as soon as a new thing is detected, that is pushed out to all of the systems. And so we had several levels of protection kicking in our product over time, some well before WannaCrypt came out, then on the day that it came out, and continue updated. Because guess what? Other people have thought, hey, I might try this. Right. And so we're seeing the same exploit now being incorporated into different types of malware. Bitcoin mining malware is one example where the bad guys try and get on your machine and use your machine to mine Bitcoin.
Make a botnet to mine Bitcoin. I gotcha.
Yep.
That's crazy. So ESET has been protecting its users already from before this infection came. So are there specific products for business or home users that are going to do a particularly good job of protecting against these kinds of cyber attacks? Because we think about antivirus, for example. This is not, this isn't going to classify itself as the traditional virus that's going to stop
that. So, you know, that's an interesting point, because traditionally our main products, our security software, has been an antivirus product.
Sure.
And, you know, when viruses, I mean, viruses come and go, but there's a lot of other kinds of malicious code, so we call it anti-malware. And wouldn't you know it, it's hard to make people say anti-malware. They still call it antivirus.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we started adding things like network protection within the product, and anti-phishing within the product, and malicious website blocking within the product. And yet we're still kind of talked about as a, you know, an antivirus company. Mm. But it's a good endpoint security product is what you're looking for. And, you know, we have a range of endpoint security products for every platform and for the business and for the consumer. And that's what you want. And these days, an endpoint security product is going to do those things. Yes, it's going to know if a new virus or worm comes out and block that. Right. But it's also going to be checking things at the network level like we do. And it's going to be looking at how the user is using the machine, so that if they're in email and they click on an attachment which is going to a, you know, an infectious website, that gets blocked.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Now, what is next for WannaCry? Are we going to start seeing this taper off with all the attention that it's been getting from cybersecurity professionals? Or is this something that's going to continue to evolve and turn into something that's...
I don't want to take this lightly, but if I had to guess, I would say that sometime on Friday, it's going to wake up again, because darn it, these things seem to hit on Friday. It just ruins your weekend.
Your poor staff.
You know, big Mirai botnet attack on the DNS services happened on a Friday. And there's actually some logic to that. If you're going to launch a piece of malware, I shouldn't even say this, but, you know, the bad guys already know it. Friday, not a bad time. You know, people are leaving early for the weekend. From a criminal perspective, it makes sense to attack on Friday. Please don't. But I honestly don't know what's going to happen next. You know, it depends which of these scenarios WannaCry conforms to. You know, who is doing it, and what's the point?
Is there any clue? Is there any clue? Like, is this thing calling home at all? Or
so, you know, there's North Korea has been floated. Because of similarities of, you know, the big chunks of code in WannaCry, which are also in code related to the Lazarus Group, which is associated with North Korea.
Okay.
And but that's not conclusive at all.
We don't know. We just don't know.
Well, I would say this, that myself and my colleagues at ESET are very conservative around attribution.
Sure.
Because it's in the nature of code that it can be exactly replicated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like an MP3 recording. You can just clone it ad infinitum, right? I mean, you can patch things together. And So what we, if we see a similarity, our first suspicion is a red flag, right? Red flag, false flag.
For the definition?
Freudian slip there. Hmm. Yeah, not all false flags are red flags, sorry.
Okay, so you mean in your definitions when you see that? And
yeah, so we have actually seen code which where somebody's trying to make it look Russian.
Oh, okay.
Right. So it's a known thing in malware writing is to throw artifacts in there to throw people off if they're trying to find out who wrote it.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Stephen, I appreciate your time very, very much. I mean, we're going to see this thing evolve, I think, over the next little while. Hopefully it does not hit you on Friday, but keep up the great work there at ESET and you know, with all the protection that you're providing, the proactive nature of the ESET products. Make sure you check them out. It's ESET.com. Stephen Cobb joined us tonight, and thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Have yourself a great night.
You too.